Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On March 13, 1980, in Ventura County, California, prominent attorney Lyman Robert Smith, on the verge of being appointed a Superior Court judge, and his wife Charlene were murdered in their home. Author Ann Penn, her actual name Lori, is the couple's niece. She was close to her grandfather, Lyman's father, and saw the devastating impact the murders had on the family. Once she realized it was the work of East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker, Lori vowed to do all she could to investigate and help solve the incredible serial murder mystery. She was hopeful, convinced that advances in familial DNA, along with dogged law enforcement, would make an arrest. And she believed the killer still and had always lived in Sacramento, and that East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker had possibly targeted her family members 400 miles away in Southern California to kill them. FBI investigator Paul Holes used DNA recovered from one of the East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker crime scenes to first find the killer's great-great-grandparents and painstakingly worked through thousands of relatives to the present day. The investigation led to a 72-year-old retiree living in the Sacramento suburb of Citrus Heights. On April 24th, Joseph James D'Angelo was arrested. Lori will discuss the case, her reaction, her predictions and conclusions, and what she will do now regarding this still, for her, unfolding investigation. The subject that we're dealing with this evening in the book, East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer Unmasked, A Family Member Speaks Out. Ann Penn, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Ann Penn, or, as I should say, Lori. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan. How are you?
Oh, very fine, thank you. Very fine, thank you. First off, I haven't spoken to you personally, and I wanted to save this moment and savor it for just your thoughts. Where were you? How did you hear about this? Tell us about this. What was your reaction?
Well, it was really amazing that I haven't been to Sacramento in a while to visit friends, and I was taking a break and was actually in Sacramento visiting and was staying with a friend. And I said, can I check the computer? I didn't bring my laptop. I didn't bring any devices, anything with me. And so I was on the computer for a few minutes and realized something was happening with the case, and that I was like, well, it sounds kind of vague and not really, I'm not sure. And then I talked to one of the people on the pro boards that I kind of check in on about the case, and he reassured me. He said, I promise you, Ann, it is 100% real and it's 100% DNA match. And that's when I could go to bed. It was 3 o'clock in the morning by then. I was trying to find details and information for about 3 hours. So the next morning I was told they would have a press conference in Sacramento. And so it was just very surreal because I'm never in Sacramento except to visit friends once in a while. And I actually ended up at the home of a friend that, ironically enough, was the friend who, when I was chased down the street in 1971, it was her front door I ran to. I was actually in her home when I found this out. I was just like, wow.
Wow. Yeah. That's a wow moment. Wow.
She was like, I can't believe this. You know, I said, talk about full circle. You know, when the fear began, when I got chased, and it went on until all of a sudden I'm relieved that this guy's sitting in a little box. I was actually driving on the freeway past J Street, and the next day after the announcement by all the different jurisdictions, and I I have to tell you, I mentally had to give him a, what do you call it, with your hand?
Thumbs down.
Something.
At least.
Yeah. It was great relief to know he was just a few blocks away sitting in a box.
Yeah, and you sound a lot better, too. I mean, you sound different. I mean, I just interviewed Richard Shelby, and I'm sure, like you said, nobody's celebrating in law enforcement, but it's relief, and it's a different response for you. This means more. I mean, if it can mean more than it means to a dedicated detective who's lived with it his entire career and then beyond, right up to the present moment, but as we will hear from you, it can, and it has.
It's
when
been an interesting roller coaster of emotions, so. Yeah.
I would say, certainly, understatement. Mm-hmm. Now, when you found out the name, and again, I alluded to that, you know, this is now, what will Lori do regarding this still for her unfolding investigation? And I'm trying to be dramatic, but it's not untrue that this is still unfolding for you. You're still, I know from the two books that you've written already, your obsession with this case, your need to solve this. You've done a lot of speculation, you've done a lot of predicting, you've done a lot of encouraging, we'll say, and criticism, where criticism may be needed. But what happened when you heard the name Joseph James DeAngelo and then realized, as like Richard Shelby has said, he's been there since the 70s in Citrus Heights. What was your reaction when you heard, number one, that you had predicted all along that he was from Sacramento, he still is in Sacramento, and so what was your reaction when, number one, you thought you were right, that was verified? What was your reaction to finding out where he had lived?
Well, of course, I wasn't the only one who had come to that conclusion, but I investigated the case, as you know, over time for quite some time. And one day I picked up the phone and I called Larry Crompton, who I had previously contacted after I had read his book a couple years back. And I said, here's what I think. And he was really great because he always listened and he always believed whatever it was you had to say, and he was always very supportive. And I said, this is what I think. I think that he is from Sacramento. I think he lived in Sacramento at the time. I think he's still there. I think he's probably never been in any trouble, which is why we can't find his DNA. And it was terrifying to me to think that he was still not too far from where I lived. And I wrote a book about him. So that was kind of scary. But I wanted to get the word out to Sacramento people because I was so certain that he was still there because he was arrogant. He was living under everyone's nose. It's not untypical of a serial killer to try to fit into a community and just stay there and kind of hide in a family, which is what he did, and never leave that area. And what's really arrogant about him was that he picked Citrus Heights to buy a home in 1979, and he lived in his attack areas, and that just irks me no end, I can't tell you. I'm sure it irks all the victims and all the families that are involved that he was just sitting there all this time and thought that he would never be caught. And he was even surprised when they arrested him because he really probably never thought they would figure it out. So
now you talk about in your book, and you talk personally that you had a lot of conversations with Paul Holes, the lead investigator. And as I spoke to Richard Shelby yesterday, last evening on the interview, he said that credit really has to go to a lot of people, but especially Paul Holes for being innovative and also just the great work he was doing. And I don't know if he was the official spokesman for the FBI, but he sure acted as such. Tell us about some of the conversations you had with Paul Holes and the relationship you developed, you know, even though you're on different sides of the equation here in this case.
Right.
And also a little bit about the explanation. I have the explanation on what exactly he did, but tell us a little bit about your relationship with Paul Holes before this arrest.
Well, the day that I told Larry Crompton that I thought he was still in Sacramento, I think his jaw probably hit the floor because he was surprised that that was the conclusion I had come to. And within the hour after that conversation, he had me on the phone with some volunteers who worked the case in Sacramento and who were looking into different persons of interest over time. And they also had thought the same thing, or at least were investigating people that were persons of interest from that area at the time, and that was a couple years back. And so after that conversation, he also talked to Paul Holes, and we set up a conversation. So I've been talking with him on and off for a couple of years as well. Typically, he would call me when he was in the car on the way home, and we'd chat for however long it took him to get there. Sometimes it'd be 30 or 40 minutes. And then he also, of course, as he's stated on television over and over, was in the same mind frame as I was and Larry was and many others probably were, that he was still in Sacramento and that he just would hop on the freeway there, Highway 80 or Highway 99, and go to either Stockton on 99 or he would head out to Concord or wherever he was going from Sacramento. So the relationship I had with Paul was we were trying to, before they decided to go ahead and go to the genealogy site, we were talking about different other thoughts and theories about how there might be a connection from Sacramento to my uncle's murder and Charlene's murder. We were investigating different thoughts on that. I talked to the FBI and I talked to Paul about different theories that we had because a lot of people thought, well, gee, there might be some connection to Citrus Heights and to my grandfather and Lyman Smith who lived in Citrus Heights. They lived there for until 1960, but they had moved in 1960, so they weren't there in the 70s at that time. So we were trying to figure out if there was some connection because my uncle was in Sacramento the week before he was murdered, and he had connections there and, you know, development and different things that he was doing in business. So we were discussing a lot of different theories and a lot of different things over time before in the last 2 years. And then one of the things, of course, that was always a topic of conversation was the DNA connection to, you know, some kind of family member and how to go about doing that. So, I just was anxious, like most people were, to find out, well, why is it taking so long? Why don't we just do it, you know? Because people would talk about that kind of thing. Back in 2005, they started to try to figure out how to connect criminals and through DNA. So anyway, it was a long wait.
Now let's talk more about Charlene Smith and the former Charlene Doyle, and also your uncle, who you called Uncle Bob, and the only other people referred to him as Uncle Bob. And I talked about how he was a prominent lawyer and on the verge of being appointed a judge, where there's a very, very good possibility. In your investigation, you also talked about speaking with Colleen Kaysen. And so tell us more about this possible connection with Citrus Heights. Before you found out about Joseph James DeAngelo and his connection to Citrus Heights, you were already on that Citrus Heights trail. So reviewing your book again, I'm amazed at some of the things that you have said there. Now, in light of what has happened, do you think, as I alluded to in the show description, that there is a more sinister connection and reason for your uncle and your aunt being targeted in, 400 miles away from Sacramento?
Well, it's one of two things. It was either a major coincidence that they were, you know, related to people from Sacramento, that my grandfather and grandmother lived off the Highway 99 freeway there, or it was something that maybe this guy saw Charlene and Lyman in Sacramento when they were there visiting. They would visit my grandparents in, you know, it's close to downtown Sacramento. So, you know, like I said, or it's just a major coincidence, but we were looking into what the connections were and who who Lyman knew in Sacramento and things like that for a while, because, you know, you never know what the one thing is that's going to connect it all and the one thing that's going to solve it. And obviously it was DNA. So I guess over time we'll find out, you know, maybe we won't. Maybe we'll never find out those details. I don't know what kind of details this guy might give up, and I know that the investigators have their hands full trying to figure out who did what and where and when and how it all connected. It just amazed me over time that, as I said in the book, it was like I was doing some kind of dance with this guy, because when I found out he was in Auburn, that was shocking to me, because I was married in Auburn in 1980. The reason I got married in Auburn was because I loved being up there. I used to go there for hikes, used to go off of Auburn, off the major road there. It was a mile from where this criminal was married. I was married in a church a mile away from where he was. He was a police officer in Auburn while I was going there all the time after work to go hiking. It just blows my mind. I really thought that somewhere along the way that I probably crossed paths with the guy. And I always felt that.
What I thought interesting I was just going to mention the Auburn, because that's what was startling to me, is these, again, seeming coincidences. But the other one I wanted to put out to you was that, you know, given what you already know, and I'm interviewing Richard and rereading his book as well, I realized he's taunting police to a certain degree. He is certainly thinks he's much smarter and outsmarted police. He's employing things such as accents to throw off and all kinds of other techniques that
right.
he could have certainly learned quite a bit of information from being a police officer in the 6 years that he did to be able to throw off law enforcement. So he has some issue with thinking he's much smarter than law enforcement. Would it mm-hmm. have extended to your Uncle Bob, who was on, like I say, the verge ship of being appointed a superior court judge, a prominent lawyer, a former district attorney,
mm-hmm.
Again, a super popular person in the school he was with a woman 10 years his junior, so in a very
mm-hmm.
attractive woman. But also, I just thought more so the idea of law enforcement, where the other crimes, there seemed to be no one of any, not I would say prominence, but again, law enforcement, taunting of police,
right.
a possible judge, and the connection.
Yeah.
It seems even more or less, actually, less coincidental.
I suppose he could have read something in the newspaper and decided that would be his target, or he could very simply have just seen Charlene down by the ocean there where she was working and followed her home. Like I said, it's all speculation, but it'd be interesting. I would love for the guy to just stand up and say, yeah, I'm the guy. I did it. And here's what I can tell you. I mean, that would be amazing. But I don't think that he's going to, from what it looks like. At least BTK said, yeah, I'm BTK. You got me. But this guy, that wimpy performance in court the other day was really awful.
Makes tell us angry. About that. I didn't get to see it. So what was the pathetic display? I know he came in a wheelchair looking all
right, yeah,
you know, mopey and
looking like an old man, yeah. And according to what I've read, and I haven't had time, as you can imagine, in the last week, it's been insane and very busy, but I haven't had enough time to read enough about him yet. I actually wanted a moment to just sort of see how I felt before I try to get into the details of what this guy is or did or whatever. But he was in a wheelchair, handcuffed to the wheelchair, and acted like he was having a hard time understanding the judge. He didn't speak very clearly. I thought maybe he was sort of whispering like that so that no one could hear his voice, because if we hear his voice, that'll be one more thing that we can say, yeah, that's him. But he was just a couple weeks before that, I guess, they were surveilling him, and he was doing all kinds of stuff that was, you know, more like a 50-year-old, according to Paul Holes. And all of a sudden, he's this old man in a wheelchair. So I don't know if they had him on some kind of sedative or what, but, you know, I'm like, really? Give me a break. So.
Well, it was interesting talking to Richard because he believes that he will talk, and I was surprised. Again, I can't see in his, given the background, not to say predictability, but just given the non-sympathetic story he could present, no matter what he said, I just thought it would be odd that he would talk.
Here's what my initial reaction was. It's sort of like, well, maybe what he's doing is just trying to see kind of where everybody else sits, like what position he's in. And of course, he's in a terrible position, but because he's the guy, and he can sit there and deny it all day long. But 100% DNA match, it can't be. I can't fathom that it could be anything other than guilty.
No.
But you know, obviously, in the court of law, he has to be. He's presumed innocent until he's proven guilty. But this is a precedent-setting kind of case when it comes to what's happened with DNA being part of the equation. So we'll see what happens. In my book, I had said, why can't I see the reports? Why can't I, know what's in the paper files? Because when we find this guy, it's not going to have anything much to do with it, with what's in the files and the autopsy reports and different things. It's going to be DNA, and that's all we're going to need to know. And, I just can't fathom.
Well, they still have to refer. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Richard had said that the idea, though, that with the DNA genealogy sweep, and when they had come and narrowed it down, that they had still were using circumstantial evidence to be able to narrow things down because they had the fourth.
Right.
Cousin.
Oh, sure, of course. They had to do old-fashioned police work on top of everything. They found out he was in Auburn. They found out he was fired. They found out, all kinds of things about him and whether or not it fit, and it fit. So, yes, absolutely, they had to do the old-fashioned police work to go along with the DNA. But my point was, in my book, was like all these reports that they've had and all this information they've had for 40 years, and they haven't really, until recently, shared like pictures of what he took or the china, all this different stuff, they kept it pretty close to the vest. And so my point was just that, if you release this information, you get it out there, maybe we can solve this case. And eventually when we do find him, the DNA will match and that'll be a done deal. And that was really my point.
So, well, I think,
but I do
speaking
think
with Richard. Well, I was speaking with Richard. He had mentioned that at one point he was given the records for safekeeping, and then didn't have the ability to store them correctly, so he gave them back. That same sheriff's department, when he asked for those records again, the lead investigator, they wouldn't have had them otherwise. Then he was refused those same reports. So it seems politics really sets dictates basically what will happen. And so what I thought was fascinating and what you mentioned today is actually speaking with Paul Hull so many times and being taken seriously by the current law enforcement handling this case. So that was encouraging to me. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result of the volunteer organizations that you mentioned and all the people out there on message boards, and not that everything was good that was done on message boards and the speculation, but I think police, this is a huge day. I mentioned this yesterday. This is a huge day for law enforcement, a positive day for law enforcement.
Oh, yeah.
So I think
for
that,
sure.
So I definitely think that the good things will come from this, and they will, I think, again, go to the public and ask for their help because they...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then they realize that, they have nothing to... They have everything to gain from doing that.
Right. I have to say, too, before I get sidetracked, the people on those message boards, there are some incredible sleuths out there. The detail and the investigations that they did, and they never wavered, and they just never quit, and they pushed and pushed and pushed. And I had people contacting me personally from all over the place. It was amazing some of the things that they were looking at, and I was just grateful and amazed. They were wonderful. So I have to tell you that.
You had mentioned the volunteer organization. Do they have a name that you would like to mention as well?
Well, the Pro Boards, which is the one of the sites, is the EAR. I guess it's EARSONSGSK. Anyway, it's easy to Google it. I may have an extra S in there, but yeah. But that's where I would go, you know, just to check in and see what was going on. And like I said, there were a lot of amazing researchers and people. There's a person I worked with that's even in Canada, in your neck of the woods, and he was an incredible researcher also. He helped occasionally with some other projects too. So, and interestingly enough, his last name is Smith. So lots of Smiths out there. Yeah.
What did you think of D'Angelo's age?
I was wishing he was 62. And the reason is because I want him to be punished longer, and I don't want him to get away with acting like he's a wimpy old man. You know, I that was within the range. Everybody said, well, he's probably between 62 and 75. And I was really hopeful because he seemed so immature to me in his actions and how he sounded. And I was really hoping that he was younger. And I did say that I thought he graduated in about 73, and I was not correct about that. And I wish that he was younger so he could sit in a box a lot longer. Because what
Absolutely.
He did to all the people involved, not only murdering people, but the victims that were actually attacked by this man, all the victims that were collateral damage out here, like myself, who watched family members struggle with this, all the husbands, wives, all the people that are out there that were affected personally, and then also the community itself was absolutely in terror, and everywhere he went. And, you know, he deserves to be punished a very long time. I relish the idea that a police officer in Sacramento County, where he began his rapes, I relish the idea that he's sitting in a jail cell and that officer can come in and flip the lights on and wake him up any time he wants to. And he has absolutely no power and absolutely no control. And I'm very happy about that.
What's particularly sad about your uncle and your aunt's murder was that it was attributed to a business associate,
mm-hmm.
pardon me, and
right.
also that
yeah.
there was incredible amount of speculation, and some of it based on fact, but regardless, it almost seemed like a tone of, not almost, it seemed like a tone of they had it coming to them for some reason, either shady business or extramarital affairs or something of that, still blaming
right.
them. Tell us about that particular effect on your family. Not only is it murder, and then you say that your grandfather never really got to know the truth, that it was attributed to the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker, but you found out at some point. But
well, he knew. He died knowing that it was a serial killer. They had figured the DNA connection. He died in 2001. But yeah, it was one of the major reasons I actually wrote this book was because it irritated me. It bothered me a lot that any time that Lyman and Charlene Smith were mentioned in any publication, there was all the speculation about what type of people they were and whether a business associate or bad deals or something had happened. Now, everybody in the world who works for themselves or tries a business venture has the possibility of failing or having investments go wrong or whatever. And the speculation really irritated me, and I felt like I needed to say, hey, these people are victims of a murderer, of a serial killer, and they were way more than what is being written about them and all the sensationalism that was happening at the time and beyond. Even it was repeated year after year, even till 2012, one of them I quoted in my book, because it was just so inaccurate and so wrong, and they actually act like the victims brought this onto themselves by anything in their lives. I mean, it's just a crime in itself to blame any of the victims. There have been stories about other murder victims, and you know, this is not something that they did to themselves. in any way, shape, or form. And so I had to try to let people know what human beings they were and what wonderful people they all were, and that they were, you know, professional people, that they were in the medical profession, they were lawyers, they were all kinds of wonderful people, psychiatrists. They were just people who were living or starting their lives and who deserved to be alive. And this guy was randomly attacking and took them away.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Lori, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FTD. I'm thinking about my mother with the upcoming Mother's Day around the corner and her importance in my entire life, including my career, and how she always deserved something extra special to show her how much I appreciated her. And that something always was, that something special always meant beautiful flowers. This Mother's Day, FTD can help you express your feelings for Mom through a floral work of art that's delivered straight to her door. Sure, you could send a text, but what a great way to show the mums in your life how much you care with breathtaking flower arrangement from FTD's expert floral network. They have amazing bouquets and arrangements that will brighten the home and her day. My wife Lisa received her FTD Mother's Day arrangement from the local florist, Rollison, that my mother used and loved, used all the time. And they were entrusted to be creative for this Mother's Day arrangement, and I swear, when I saw it, it was the nicest floral arrangement I've ever seen. I had to call the florist to rave about it, but also to ask her what some of the flowers and greenery were, because most of them I've never seen before. And she told me there was a mini Cali lily, a yellow Solidago, a Florida Beauty, some bear grass, a pink Astabili, and purple Freesia, and yellow tulips. What a beautiful and incredibly unique arrangement, and what a beautiful Mother's Day gift. My wife loved it. To get 25% off a florist-styled bouquet for Mom this Mother's Day, go to ftd.com/Mother's Day. That's ftd.com/Mother's Day. That's one word, Mother's Day. ftd.com/Mother's Day. One word. FTD, we can arrange that. Let's talk more about your Uncle Bob and his wife Charlene and the life and the people that they were, but also what this did to your family, what this did to your grandparents that you were especially close to, what did this do to your grandfather and your grandmother and your entire family, as you write in the book?
Well, I can only speak for the family that was in Sacramento, but it was difficult to watch my grandfather be so heartbroken. He was very proud of both of his sons, and he especially was proud of the fact that Lyman Robert was doing so well in his career, et cetera. He was just heartbroken. He never spoke about it until 1990. We were in the car when my grandmother was in the hospital, and she was she'd had a stroke, and we had a couple days where we were trying to figure out if she was going to live or die. And I drove him to the hospital back and forth, and I stayed with him in his home. And on one of those trips back and forth, he started talking about Lyman, his son, and was telling me about when he was a little boy, he almost died from appendicitis. He said that his wife kept telling him, he needs to go to the hospital, he needs to go to the hospital. And, of course, my grandfather was a very stubborn guy. And he said, no, he'll be fine, he'll be fine. And his wife, Wilma, said, no, he really needs to go to the hospital. And I guess they kind of went around a while about that. And usually he told me that he would have just said no. But that day there was something in his wife's tone or expression that he actually took Lyman to the hospital. And if he hadn't, he would have died then. And I just listened to him, and I was just amazed that all of a sudden he was just telling me this story. And that was the only time he really talked about how Lyman almost died when he was a child. So he did get to grow up, and he did get to have a career. He did get to have his children. And so, you know, but he did really work hard and really work a lot. And it was almost like he knew he had to, you know, fit it all in really fast because he was really pushing all the time. So anyway, my grandfather was very upset about it, of course, and didn't talk about it for a long time, but he did come to my wedding. I told that story in the book about how he was in, and we were in Auburn at the church, and it was raining, and the rain was pouring down on the church. And after I was married, we were walking out of the church and to the vestibule, and my grandfather was in the vestibule with my grandmother, and he was sobbing uncontrollably, just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed, and nobody could console him. And that was only 7 or 8 weeks after his son was murdered. So, but they showed up at the wedding and did the best they could. And he had said, "No, we'll be there." My grandmother said, "Oh, no, we can't come, we can't come." And he said, "No, we'll be there," because he knew it was important. So they came, right. and so it was a tough day. But anyway.
What was their, I mean, obviously it was a negative reaction, but what was their reaction once this case picked up steam and the business associate was accused? How devastating, again, increasingly devastating or added frustration and anger? What?
I imagine it probably didn't make much sense to my grandfather. I heard about it from my grandmother. She's the one who would mention once in a while something about the case. And we heard about his business associate. It was very frustrating because it seemed like after they spent all that time trying to figure out if, I don't want to say his name because he had enough bad publicity over time.
Sure.
I'm sure he's a really nice guy. The good thing that happened for him after this was after they released him from jail, after having him in jail for a year and dismissing the charges, that they didn't have enough evidence to go to trial. But, you know, and it was financially ruining for him and his family. But his wife stood by his side. And so I know my grandfather was just, like, very frustrated by it because you want to find who did this. And they went off the wrong direction in Ventura County. And I know that they've investigated it over time. But unfortunately, at the time, it appears that the case went cold after those 2 years of investigating the wrong person. So, I mean, that's what they do. They have to investigate. They have to go with what leads. Unfortunately, there was a pastor that had started talking about how this guy had confessed, and they spent a year trying to figure out if he was a reliable witness, and he wasn't. He always tried to insert himself into cases before. So, unfortunately, it went cold in Ventura County as far as we could tell. And I know when I called Ventura County in 2016, at the beginning of the year, what they did was they said that they did not have money, or they did not have a cold case unit, and that they were investigating any leads that would come in, but they, you know, really didn't have any cold case unit. So it seemed pretty cold to me, even in 2016, until the FBI announced they were reentering the case. And that was in June of 2016.
In retrospect, now that I know this still, you haven't wrapped yourself around all the new information, but I asked this of Richard Shelby because I was curious. What do you think about eyewitness accounts and composite drawings and their effect on an investigation, positive or negative?
Well, you know, this was the 70s, and that was pretty much what they had to go with. The composites, amazingly enough, a lot of them look sort of like him. So some of the witnesses who saw a strange guy in the neighborhood or, you know, talked to investigators after the attacks, did have an interesting perspective on it. And again, it was the 70s. There wasn't much, you know, they still have to work from eyewitness accounts, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they aren't. But interestingly enough, the pictures of the Visalia ransacker look like him. And I imagine that was from McGowan's description, the detective who was flashlight got shot, and his hand, I guess, was hurt. But, yeah.
It's interesting, too. Richard Shelby chronicles the Visalia ransacker, and, of course, now there's pretty well a positive connection with the Visalia ransacker, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So they can see a lot of this perpetrator's early behavior and then evolution into a serial killer, can't they?
Right. Well, he was certainly an angry person. I heard something yesterday, and I didn't catch the whole thing on the news, but Paul Holes was talking about how after they had caught him shoplifting in Auburn, and he was a cop at the time, that he threatened the chief, and he actually was outside, and I wish I had seen the whole description, but he was outside the chief's house, and his daughter, the chief's daughter, was like, there's a man out there kind of thing. And so that probably didn't help him stay on the force, that's for sure, because he was threatening the chief. And that was just something I heard, like I said, very briefly. I wish I had more details on it, and I will find them. But for him to be outside the chief's house when he's being, you know, investigated for shoplifting and he's about to lose his career in law enforcement, there's something wrong with the guy. You know, I mean, somebody should have known that. I mean, even if he was taking a hammer and dog repellent from the store and they could write it off in their minds by saying, well, yeah, he probably could use that on the job. He could have, you know, used it for dogs when he's a police officer, whatever. But on the other hand, he was threatening the chief and he was let go from this position. So I'm just surprised, I guess, in a way that somehow the dots were not connected along the way, you know, when it came to his behavior at the time. And that was 1979.
Yeah, and the murders were in 1980. So, again,
well, they were in 79 also.
Mm-hmm.
They were in 79, and they were also in 78, if you look at the Maggiore murders. So,
sure.
You know.
No, but I was referring to your aunt and uncle specifically.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Again, law enforcement, again, you know, again, this is a representation of everything that, you know, ruined his life. It seemed like he, not that I can interpret it, but it seemed like he didn't think it was such a big deal. Obviously, again, this his arrogance, and then, you know, to be threatening mm-hmm. a police chief or think that you're not going to get repercussions, it seemed that from what I had read, he didn't think to be too fazed about what he had done. So,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, there, you know, for him to be that angry and that acting out a lot, apparently, yeah, it's amazing somebody didn't say, hey, there's something wrong with that guy, you know, especially in Citrus Heights when he was living next door to people and such. But I guess he was probably inconsistently maybe an okay guy and then other times maybe not. So I have to read more about him.
What do you think about when you talk geographically? You know, Richard Shelby talked about being able to, at one point, almost pinning down what neighborhood he would strike in next. You looked at this geographically in terms of the mm-hmm. attacks. What do you think now, since there's been this arrest? Any surprises to what you had thought?
Well, you know, you can't be right about everything when you're speculating, right? But
sure.
And I was incorrect about where he was from, but as far as like what part of Sacramento he was in, I guess probably I really never thought that we would still find him sitting in the middle of the attack area. But again, too, when you look at the geographical area of Sacramento, I mean, there's a lot of waterways. There's a lot of the American River, the Sacramento River, the creeks and waterways. There's a lot of that in Sacramento. So it wasn't a far stretch for me to think that he could find his way through the entire town in the creeks. And so I really concentrated on that a lot and tried. But then I realized, too, that was all over Sacramento. When I found out that he was in Citrus Heights, it was sort of like, yeah, okay, I get that. You know, it was not a surprise. It really wasn't. Not at all. Just arrogant.
do you think, you wrote in a book that you thought there might be some possible connection with Lake Tahoe and the cabin there. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, Lake Tahoe is somewhere that people go from Sacramento and San Francisco, L.A. They drive up and they, you know, come hang out. I wouldn't be surprised if he'd done that, especially since he was from the Auburn area. What's interesting to me about where they showed pictures of where he grew up or where he was, and it's, you know, a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of outdoor area. It's real, you know, rural. So, but, you know, he probably did come up here on occasion. So did my whole family. So did a lot of people in Sacramento. So it's hard to say if there was any kind of connection that way.
In your investigation, when you look at the murders of your aunt and uncle, were they significantly or in any significant way different than the other murders? Once you began murdering, was there any difference?
Yeah, we've talked about that before, and most people who know the case know that in 1979, the murders of Offerman and Manning, Doctors Offerman and Manning, they didn't go, I think, the way he planned exactly. He ended up shooting them. But in my uncle and Charlene's murder, they, I think, went pretty much the way he had planned it. But he also left them not covered when he bludgeoned them and seemed to learn from that because it's, I'm sure it was not, it was rather messy, but they... The next murders, he did cover the couple. And so he also took his bindings with him after the Smith murder. So he learned something from all the publicity and all the articles about what he had done and changed some of what he did on the next couple. So
he must have been pretty gratified or enjoyed not being detected for those murders. For your uncle and
yeah,
your
I'm sure. Yeah, well, I mean, he being a, you know, a lot of people thought that he was ex-military, and he was. He was
right.
An ex-cop. He was actually committing these crimes, these attacks in Sacramento, while he was a police officer. And a lot of people say ex-cop. Well, he was actually an active police officer when he was committing the rapes in Sacramento and other places in 1979, 76 through 79, he was in Auburn. So.
Yeah, that's chilling. And all the, and all of the information, valuable information that he learned as a law enforcement personnel.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when he was doing the running around in Southern California, he was, he was not only learning, but he was doing the same kind of, what did he, Paul Holes had a name for it yesterday, where he was just setting it up so that people in different jurisdictions, which back in the day they didn't speak to each other as much as they do now, and they didn't have the type of technology they have now and all that, he knew that there was a better chance he would get away with it if he moved from place to place. And he tried to change something of his MO, and so he thought he was really smart. And I sure wish they'd caught him sooner because he's not smart.
Well, he wasn't smart enough.
No.
Smart enough.
Back in the day when they were investigating things, it's not the same thing as it is today. Today you couldn't get away with what he got away with. Ted Bundy couldn't have, you know.
Yeah, but at the same time,
people would have had their cell phones taking pictures of him.
But it is nice that the advances in DNA technology, not that they have been rapid, but there have been incredible advances in DNA technology since its announcement in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
This killer would not know of that. So he, of course, was very particular, and so he knew of other technologies, techniques that the police had for collecting evidence. He had no idea what DNA would achieve, what it would become.
Right.
When did you find out? Well, we spoke about this before, but I've spoken to other authors as well, because this is a fairly new development, this being able to link up families through DNA, the familial DNA. When did you find out the FBI was employing this? Tell us.
Well, you know, it had been talked about by various people in law enforcement over time. I was just surprised that it took them a while to be able to. I think there was a lot of privacy issues that they were still considering trying to figure out. But it's definitely been on the list of things to do. What I wrote in my book back in, I think it was 2005, Tony Fridakis, he's a PhD who developed the latest technique called biogeographic testing. His technique was to take 0.1% of a person's DNA to determine the physical characteristics. So I was wondering when they were going to show us a picture, the DNA phenotyping, to show us what he looked like. And this was back in 2005. And it was supposed to be 92% accurate at that time, 2005, to show us what the guy would look like. And I couldn't figure out why we weren't getting that picture. I thought, well, maybe they're not showing it to us because they're afraid they're going to scare him off. So, yeah. So I know that they've known for a long time more about what he looked like. So, but I do have some questions, I have to tell you, about some of the evidence that seemed to be talked about a lot. And it was talked about a lot, the papers that he dropped in Danville, I believe. And the thing that I wanted to know, and I mentioned it not too long ago, was did they ever test it for epithelial cells? Do they know for a fact that it really was him who dropped it? Maybe he did drop it. Maybe he did it on purpose to try to get them to talk to themselves about the drawing that he did, and also the papers he wrote about being mad and so on. And so I want to know, do they know for a fact, and I really want to know whether they were even his papers. That's one thing. And I have a few questions that you can imagine. I had some people ask me, let's see, what did they say? Did he stop killing when he became a father? I think so. I think that he took a break. He had three daughters. One of them, interestingly, was born in 81, and I think his wife was pregnant at the time he was did a murder. And then also in 86, the same thing, his wife was pregnant. So I think that he did stop because he had a family. Somebody else asked me, let's see. And they asked me if I thought he'll talk. I think eventually he might talk. I think he's trying to assess kind of where he sits at the moment before he opens his mouth. Everybody's got lots of questions.
Very interesting. Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine you would have an incredible amount, and I don't think it would end any time soon. It wouldn't be satisfied by just a few answers. Mm-hmm. What we got to mention before we go is also that Paul Holes, again, Richard Shelby gave him a lot of credit, but you sent me an article as well talking about Paul Holes, explaining what really happened is that they had the DNA, but a sweep of databases, like you say, he didn't have a record, even despite this altercation when he was a police officer, he didn't have a record as a result. So Paul Holes had an idea. He had an idea derived from somebody else's idea, and then he applied that idea to use a sweep of just general genetic sites.
Right.
So like Ancestry.com, and that's not the one they used. Apparently they used it's another one. Regardless, I have it down here somewhere. But a general sweep, and then found the great-great-grandparents and went back several years.
It was actually his great-great-great-grandparents. They went to 1800.
Exactly, And so then divided it up into sort of family trees and then be able to eliminate and investigate through that. And that's what took, it seems like, a fair amount of time to be able to do that.
Sure. Well, what I found interesting was that they said in their public announcement that this guy was not on their radar until 6 days prior to his arrest.
That's right.
6 days, yeah. And so I was thinking, But anyway, just so you know, too, I have to say that Larry Crompton is the person who talked to Paul Holes way back, and they discussed trying to match the DNA, trying to get samples to the right people to match the DNA, and they're the ones who actually put it all together when it came to matching the East Area Rapist with the original Night Stalker. And so, you know, of course, Larry was retired, but he was the one who said, hey, why don't you do this? And so it was that and working with Paul Holes, Larry's never stopped. And I need to make sure that everyone understands how much this man put into this case over time. He has never stopped. And I know that Richard Shelby has also been very vocal, and Carol Daly and a lot of the people that are in Sacramento and a lot of the people that are in other jurisdictions. I never spoke to them, so I don't know their names, but I've seen them on television. But they've all worked so hard and never stopped. So,
yeah, I congratulated.
It took a community, and it took a community not only of the people, but of law enforcement as well. So,
yeah, I congratulated Detective Shelby because it is a group effort of law enforcement and other people, but you know, law enforcement. And then we also just briefly spoke because he said he didn't want to make it sound like sour grapes, but I was angered, and as I'm sure some other people were too, when credit is not given. And Larry Crompton was on the program, the first person that talked about East Area Rapist and his book, Sudden Terror, which is just essential, mm-hmm. along with Richard Shelby's book, Hunting a Psychopath, essential. And then we have, you know, a tabloid television program announcing very, very early on after the rest that Barbara McNamara's book, Into the Dark.
Oh, it's Michelle.
In the Dark of the Night. Pardon me. Michelle,
yeah.
McNamara. It was receiving credit for naming. TMZ said that she named the suspect, but then it mm-hmm. turned into all of the articles just, again, using sort of the headline to mention how important the book was, and without the book, the investigation never would have done what it did. Give us
none of us
the,
believe
set
that.
The record straight.
Yeah, none of us believe that it was attributed to that book, and that's what they've said. Police, law enforcement has said that no, there was nothing in that book that contributed to what happened with the DNA. I mean, that was going to happen regardless, and so that's really what the record should state. But the fact is it did take an entire community, and Michelle McNamara did call attention to the case. There's no doubt, and so she deserves
sure.
credit for that. And it's too bad that she's not here to see it, because I know she put her heart and soul into it as well, as many of us did. And, you know, that's why I was compelled to write my book and try to get to the Sacramento audience and say, who did you know? You know, did you know this guy? You know, he it was just something I had to do. And I know that she felt she had to do what she did as well. So, and there are other victims, Jane Carson Sandler, who wrote a book about what happened to her. And there are other people out there who, you know, really did 24/7 live and breathe this case and try to figure out who this guy was. So it was an absolute concerted effort. You could feel the energy moving towards this resolve. And so I'm very glad that that happened. And I just wish he was younger and he could be punished longer.
Well, I think that he just might be fit enough, and then I think maybe the state might just be helping him, have his health maintained during this period so that mm-hmm. he can, as you say and as you wish, sort of live out his life behind bars after escaping
yeah.
justice for so many years. So,
I also feel sorry for his family, but there's nothing that anyone can do, so...
Certainly. People will think about,
yeah.
oh my God, what was running through his daughter's minds, his ex-wife's mind, his granddaughter's mind that lived with him in the home, friends mm-hmm. and acquaintances, I'm sure, will be shocked, surprised, definitely, no matter what
yeah.
temperament he would have, they would still be certainly surprised at this.
Yeah, that he could go that far, that he could be this evil. Yep.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, in terms of sympathy, as I said, I can't see him talking I can't see how he can, you know, have any sympathy, anyone can have any sympathy towards him and his story. And Richard Shelby and Larry Crump have all done a good job. I don't think anybody could ever have any sympathy for this killer, given the circumstances and the all the facts of this case. There's no way. So I can't see what he would gain from opening his mouth.
Yeah. Well, I think that he may eventually talk, because I think that he's arrogant enough to really want to take credit for what he did and maybe talk about it, because he knows that people will write the details, and they will. And it'd be interesting for you and I to talk again, Dan, about this once this story unfolds some more, because it will, and there will be more details, I'm sure. So.
Yeah, I invited Larry Crompton to come on and talk about his book and about this case, but I'm sure he's busy or has better things to do. But it would be nice to have you both on and talk about this case at another point, because, go ahead.
I was just going to say I'm going to be seeing him very soon. I'd planned a trip to go visit him, actually, and I'm still going to go. So I'll be seeing him in person here shortly, but he, I know he's extremely busy. He's been interviewed like crazy, and he's been in the Oregonian type papers and places like that. You'll catch up with him sooner or later.
Yeah, certainly. What's next for you? I alluded that, again, I said that this is still an ongoing investigation. Will there be another book? What's your next move regarding this case?
Well, you know, what was ironic is that I've been talking to another author. His name's Kevin Sullivan, and he writes books about Ted Bundy. And I said, you know, I'm really looking for a case that I can write about that's been solved. And this was probably 2 or 3 weeks ago I said that. And now this has been solved, basically. And so we'll see how it plays out. But certainly there's a few chapters to add. There's no doubt about that. And people have been asking me, are you going to write about it? Are you going to write about it? Probably. I can't fathom not finishing the story. But we shall see.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And I'm sure there's so much more to learn. I mean, even without a confession, that they're the same army of people that were interested in all of the facts surrounding this case. And now with everybody that's Johnny-come-lately come on board, it's amazing to hear true crime fans that, you know, weren't up to speed on this case now try to digest all the material that's coming out. Because it's such a fascinating case. If people think the Zodiac and the Zodiac movie and the Zodiac books were incredible, I think that the publishing business in general, not just true crime, I mean television, documentaries, you name it, this is going to be the story that is going to be the biggest story of anybody's heard. It has all those elements. It was amazing that it didn't have the attention that you and I and a lot of people thought it deserved, but certainly it's going to achieve that now, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I would think so. I think everybody's been hearing about it and talking about it. And you're right. I couldn't fathom that it wasn't solved and that it was just sort of sitting there by the wayside for a long, long time. It seems that way when you're part of a family of people who are waiting for it to be solved and you want it to be solved yesterday. And so, it was finally getting some attention. I found it interesting that all the shows had finally come out and been said and done. All the books were out there, and then it gets solved. So, it's been interesting to watch and to watch it up close. And I'm glad that I did contact the people I contacted and did start talking about this, because it was the fear in the back dark resources of my mind that I needed to get rid of. And the way to do that was to talk about this, because it was too terrifying. I still am afraid sometimes, but it's after this happened, just so you know, I went outside in my yard and stood with my bare feet on the grass, and I just tried to take it all in. So he's not there. He's not going to be outside my window. He's not there. And I, for the first time, actually did my dishes without worrying about turning the light off quickly at night. So anyway, I'm glad that it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's It's nice to be able to use your own name. And again, this fear that you had, should I come out again, is based on something that happened a long, long, long time ago. And we talked about that earlier. Again, I read your book, reread your book, and we talk about the man in the puffy jacket at the meeting where the Italian man rants and raves about how it's done in his own country. And then, so I just can't imagine, and that's why we'll have to do another follow-up show, just all the things that you examined, all of the little leads. I'd like to hear, as you find out more information and you further investigate, just some more interesting and fascinating subjects surrounding this case.
Yeah. Yep.
I want to thank you very, very much, Anne, actually Anne Penn, but Lori, for coming on and talking about the East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer. And also, we just wanted to talk about your book, Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer, Family Member Speaks Out. Anne Penn, thank you very much for this interview and hope to speak to you again soon.
Yes, and thank you, Dan, very much. I appreciated your time.
Is there a website for people might want to reach out to you? Tell us a little bit about just contact information or where they might look at your work.
Well, I have a Twitter account, AnnePenn13. I have you can contact me at AnnePenn13@gmail.com. I have a WordPress account. It's AnnePenn.wordpress, I believe it is. sort of like a phone number. You don't call it yourself. So that there's a lot of different things I've blogged about on there regarding this case, and it's all under Anne Penn, and you can always Google that too. I've had a lot of interest all over the world in the last, well, it's been ongoing, but in particular, you know, all kinds of different countries, Malaysia, China, Australia, you name it. It's been interesting to see how many people are hearing about this case. So.
Yes. Absolutely. Yep. Congratulations to you, and I'm glad to see that this case was solved. It really was the purpose of your book and the purpose of your mission here. Thank you very much, Penn. Otherwise, Lori, have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.